In this episode, we speak with Yotam Gidron, who teaches and researches African history at the University of Durham. We speak with Amina El Abed, who is a partner at the consulting firm Impact Peace. We talk about the emergence of Pan-Arabism, the rise of Nasser, the role of Sadat, and the role of the continent of Africa in the machinations of the Middle East. It's hard to overestimate the influence of Gamal Abdel Nasser. Now, he came into power in 1954 through a coup, and he led Egypt till his death. He basically regalvanized not just Egypt, but the whole Arab region on this so-called idea of Pan-Arabism. Now, after Nasser passed away, he was replaced by Anwar Sadat. Now, the government that Anwar Sadat led would be the first Arab state to recognize Israel, further changing the geopolitical landscape forever. Now we hear a recording of an interview of Sadat.
In 1948, the creation of the State of Israel provoked war. Victory for the Jews enlarged that state. 600,000 Arabs left Palestine as refugees. 19 years later, in the Six-Day War of 1967, Israel humiliated the Arab enemy, occupied Arab land, and secured wider frontiers once more.
I'm not going to Geneva to discuss the possibility of the withdrawal, the Israeli withdrawal from the land occupied after 67, at all. This is a fact. Put yourself in my shoes. Could you accept bargaining on your land? I'm not ready to bargain on 1 inch of my land at all the Arab land. Israel knows this quite clearly. Our ultimate goal from the Geneva Conference is to establish permanent peace.
So now we speak with Yotam Gidron, who teaches African history at the University of Durham.
Let's maybe start with the Middle East before we plunge into the Cold War, because I think the ground zero for like Israel-Africa relations in terms of the Middle East, as they are for Israel in the Middle East, are in the late 40s, in 1948, and in Israel's establishment and the war of 1948, which kind of set
the war of independence. Yeah,
the war of independence for Israelis and the catastrophe of the Nakba, or the Nakba for Palestinians, in which Israel. Israel established itself as a state. Palestinians were displaced mostly from what was essentially before that Palestine into neighboring countries,
like Jordan
and Lebanon, Syria. Some of them, a small number, to Egypt as well. And in the following years, obviously, Israel's kind of place in the Middle East, in the following years, and essentially until today, has kind of been shaped by these events. And then, the late 40s, obviously most countries in Africa are still colonies. And it's throughout the 1950s that, or the late 1950s, that Israel gradually comes to realize that maybe it needs Africa. So these years, we see the rise of kind of a post-colonial, what was used to be called the Third World or the Afro-Asian movement. And what emerges is kind of a battle between Israel and the Arab world over what should be the place of essentially Israel or the Israeli-Arab conflict within this rising kind of group of state at the international level. Should Israel be recognized as a young post-colonial state that is essentially equal to all of these new countries that are emerging from colonial situations around the world? Or is Israel itself a colonial power that established itself as a colony in the Middle East? And this tension was always there, and it kind of influenced Israel's position in Africa in the following years. So Israel had some ties with Liberia and Ethiopia, but its main kind of ally in Africa in the late 50s was Ghana. And we see how in the years, in the late 50s and early 60s, in the years that most African countries gained independence and there was a lot of kind of pan-African activity leading essentially to the formation of the Organization of African Unity, there were a lot of debates between African countries around what position they should take as nations and as the continent vis-a-vis the situation in the Middle East. And this was, of course, shaped by the rivalry between Israel and, I would say, the Arab world, but essentially Egypt, over the alliance of Africa, or the kind of Africa's position with regard to this conflict. So Israel was trying to recruit African support for its own position and objectives, and Egypt under Nasser was investing quite a lot of energy as well in trying to persuade African countries to stand on its side in this conflict. So I'm speaking quite a lot. I don't know if you want to...
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine. Just keep,
take this in a specific direction.
Not necessarily. I think the next direction would be the emergence of Pan-Arabism. Before that, I mean, we know the very first country in Africa to recognize Israel is South Africa in 1948. And then, like you said, then as the nation started getting independence, then majority of them actually recognize Israel, like Nigeria did when it got its independence, so as well as Senegal in the 60s. But then one of the most important points is 1956 and the Suez Crisis. Could you talk a bit about the Suez Crisis and what exactly happened and Israel's role in that?
So it's late 1956 that Israel invades the Sinai Peninsula
with Britain and France. Egypt.
And it's supported by Britain and France, two at the time, of course, colonial powers. And I think when we look at Africa, we see maybe two contradictory implications or two important implications to this event. Israel was essentially had to give this territory back to Africa, back to Egypt, sorry. And obviously, launching this invasion with two colonial powers wasn't a great move for a country that was at the time trying to brand itself as a post-colonial independent state that essentially opposes colonialism. But at the same time, one thing that this invasion did achieve, for Israel at least, is that it opened the Red Sea for Israeli shipping. So Israel has, or had and still has, a port in the Red Sea, in Eilat. And throughout the early 50s, the right of Israeli ships to travel through the Red Sea to Africa was contested because of Egypt's opposition to this.
Yes.
And after the 1956 war, Israel regained its rights to Israeli ships gained the right to travel through this area. And essentially this opened Israel's access to the Red Sea, at the time Ethiopia, and then East Africa, opening trade routes mainly, which Israeli shipping companies used throughout the following years. And of course, this episode took place right before the kind of wave of African independence, which began in the late 50s. And as you say, Israel was quick to understand the leverage and the power that may come with the friendship of as many as possible African countries, and invested quite a lot of energy in African diplomacy in the late 50s and early 60s, trying very often to identify the potential leaders of African countries before they gained independence, to ensure that once they do gain independence, they will recognize Israel and establish ties with Israel. And that meant identifying these people, approaching them through perhaps other contacts in the continent, and already before independence, trying to put forward plans for future cooperation on military, civilian project development, to make sure that once countries gain independence, they are on Israel's side rather than Egypt.
Exactly. I mean, let's talk a bit about Egypt and in the 1950s. How important was Gamal Abdel Nasser to the emergence or the rise of Pan-Arabism? And how important was this as a factor in how Israel engaged with Egypt and the continent as a whole? Because as we know, majority, you know, of the states, particularly in the northern half of Africa, were strongly on the side of Egypt.
Yeah, so I mean, I'll perhaps leave questions that deal more with internal Egyptian history to someone who is who might have this as his expertise. But I think the interesting part is that, yes, Pan-Arabism emerges as an important kind of ideology in the Middle East, but Nasser works to ensure that African countries are mobilized and stand on the Arab side of this conflict. So in a sense, trying to project the influence of Pan-Arabism, not only to North Africa, obviously Arab countries that are part of this, but also to countries further south. So in East Africa, obviously Sudan, Tanzania, Kenya, countries that where populations could be influenced by Pan-Arab ideologies. And in a sense, we see these dynamics, the Israeli-Arab rivalries kind of influencing a lot of the conflicts that occur, not really in Arab countries, but kind of at the frontier between Africa and the Arab world. So in Sudan, in Ethiopia, and Eritrea, throughout the 60s mainly, and later in later decades also through Libya, places that kind of lie at the at the meeting point between Africa and the Arab world, were always places that the Israeli-Arab conflict influenced. So for instance, yeah, as I said, both the conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea, or the Eritrean rebel groups that already emerged in the 60s, and the conflict between, or the conflict in South Sudan or Southern Sudan at the time between rebels and the Sudanese government were influenced by Israel's or the Israeli-Arab conflict, with both sides kind of using proxy actors or trying to influence the outcome of these wars through propaganda, through military assistance, to achieve their own ends.
That's exactly very interesting. But let's talk a bit about what's going on within Israel and within the continent as well, as these things are happening, and particularly around a very significant point, which is the 1979 Egypt-Israeli peace treaty, which was preceded by the 1978 Camp David Accords. I mean, now research tells us that, you know, a lot of the reason why Sadat sought peace was the machinations on the continent. So we see that there was the Ethiopian Revolution by the Derg in 74, I think. And they had their own view and they were kind of hostile to the Egyptian government. And then you also had the conflict with Libya. Not so much a conflict, but like a quarrel, really. Like, you know, Gaddafi was in charge and Gaddafi was Gaddafi. And then, like you mentioned, the conflict in the Sudan. So they had all these things around them. And they were the Soviets as well were making inroads in that part of the African continent, as well as the Americans. So what was going on in Israel in how they sought to approach the continent, particularly in light of the 1979 Camp David Accords, 1979 peace treaty?
So I think there's a point we didn't really mention, and that's the 73 war, during which, after Israel had its kind of success in Africa in the 60s, most countries cut diplomatic ties with Israel because of the war in 1973, during mm-hmm. which Israel invaded Egypt and occupied the Sinai Peninsula, and kind of lost its battle to try to brand itself as a post-colonial state or mm-hmm. a kind of a part of the post-colonial movement. After the war in 1973, there are a couple of things that kind of changed Israel's place in the world and by implication, its relationship with Africa as well. One is that it emerges as a very strong ally of the US in the Middle East, something that to some extent was always there, but became very, very influential in the 1970s and later 80s. In Israel's relationship in Africa. The other is that after the war in 1973, its arms industry expands massively, which also shapes its relationship with countries in Africa. And in a sense, the other thing, and you asked about the peace agreement, what the peace agreement also signified, I think, in Israel's relationship with Africa is kind of a shift from the Israeli-Arab rivalry in Africa to an Israeli-Palestinian rivalry in Africa. Egypt had peace with Israel, recognized it, essentially. The Palestinian conflict, of course, was not over, but in a sense, the broader conflict between Israel and the Arab world kind of shifted more into a conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, where the Arab world kind of supports the Palestinians but is less and less at war with Israel. It is a gradual process, I think, that we see kind of happening until today. And then throughout the 1980s, from the very early 80s, Israel manages to reestablish its relationship with several African countries, kind of leveraging its close relationship with the US, so offering African countries that had a problematic relationship with the US assistance with kind of advocacy or persuading the US to support them. That's one thing. The second is promising security assistance to countries or to leaders that were facing all sorts of threats. So that kind of what shaped Israel's relationship with African countries in the 80s. And in a sense, the peace with Egypt opened the door for these developments, because once Egypt recognized Israel, there seemed to be no reason for African countries to maintain their hostility to Israel, or at least no reason for them not to normalize relations once again. If there's an African Arab country that has re-established relations with Israel, then essentially the main kind of reason that African countries broke ties with Israel in the 70s kind of disappeared.
You mentioned is a very fantastic point, that you know the 70s is shifted from sort of an Arab-Israeli debacle to a more specific Israeli-Palestine conflict. And you had more Arab states who sought things to gain from engaging with Israeli states on equal footing. But perhaps not, you know, not overtly, but surreptitiously. Many of them were firmly allied to the Israeli state. But let's talk a bit about the Middle East in general and the African continent relationship, particularly in light of international organizations like the United Nations. What was the relationship between the Middle East countries and the African continent, and how they engaged with, you know, major powers on the world stage, so Russia, and then the US, and so on and so forth?
Wait, you began with the UN or with?
With the UN, with the major organizations, the United Nations, and so on and so forth. So Middle East and Africa, and how they engage with that, with themselves, and also with bigger countries.
So I think if we look at the Middle East, the conflict in the Middle East, or Israel in the Middle East, so Israel, the Israeli-Arab conflict, and later the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, throughout their history have repeatedly been shaped by what happens in the UN. UN resolutions, UN Security Council resolutions, General Assembly resolutions. It was always an important part of this conflict. Perhaps not always with very significant implications, but it was always a kind of a forum where the battles that take place in the Middle East also unfold kind of in the US. And for Israel, Africa always seemed like a really valuable continent because it was always kind of between Israel and the Arab world, but not necessarily allied with either. And I think there was always this kind of fantasy on the Israeli side that African countries can be persuaded to kind of overwhelmingly support Israel in the UN and therefore guarantee Israel's objectives. And there are different, we see this dynamic operating in different ways throughout the years. So throughout the maybe 50s and 60s, there were some issues that were more important to Israel, like the issue of Palestinian refugees. Later the 1967 war, so the issue of the occupied territories. And then perhaps even more recently in the last couple of years, questions surrounding the status of Palestine as a state reached the UN as well. And Israel always hoped to get the support of as many countries as possible. And that includes Africa, of course. And I think in a sense, it never really worked. African countries generally remained on the Arab and later Palestinian side, even though Israel's closer allies sometimes kind of shifted a bit towards Israel, maybe kind of either abstained or not vote in resolutions that Israel think are important for Israel. But in a sense, it was never this overwhelming support from 50 plus countries, or almost 50 if we exclude North Africa, as Israelis often do when they think about Africa. This kind of never happened. Even countries that had a close relationship with Israel in the 60s and 50s usually tended to support the Arab side when they voted in the UN. And even countries that renewed ties in the 80s and 90s and until today mostly continue to support the Palestinian side. It's not always the case. Some countries sometimes vote differently, and Israel very much tries to promote this. But in a sense, it continues to be so until today. And I think in a way that demonstrates something that is often not taken into account when we think about Africa and the Middle East, or Africa's place in the world in general, and that is kind of the African agency in managing these relationships. Because of course, Israel comes often with leverage of security assistance, or the US, and countries in the Arab world may come with significant amounts of money, and we see how African countries were often able to kind of maneuver in between these two sides, or kind of manage their relationships in a way that they can benefit from ties with Israel to the extent that is acceptable from the point of view of other countries, but at the same time maintain their good relationship with perhaps Israel's rivals, if we may call them this way, by, for example, voting on their side at the UN. So even countries that had a very good, until today, relationship with Israel on the bilateral level may still vote against it in international forums. Partly this also relates to the fact that African countries often shape their views on these issues through the African Union today, or the Organization of African Unity before, and then within these forums, there's greater influence of Arab countries, partly because they are African as well. And then once a position is taken by the AU, it's more difficult to for African countries to vote against it in the UN. So in a sense, Israel always felt, and particularly since the establishment of the African Union, that it is that it needs more influence within this institution in order to impact also how African countries vote in the UN.
Well, thank you so much for that answer. It covered a lot of ground. So the next question now is the relationship between the African continent and the Middle East in the 20th century on a broader perspective and how they relate. I mean, you already touched a bit about that in the previous answers. But just so the nature of security assistance, the nature of sharing intelligence, the nature of sharing infrastructural projects, and then financing. And Israel is a big investor on the African continent as well. And what do these relationships mean for the wider geopolitics of the region? Because when people speak about Africa and Middle East, they always insert Europe in the middle of it in how they discuss the continent. But just if you remove Europe and you just, you know, have Africa and Middle East, how do these two countries relate? These two regions relate on the geopolitical front?
You mean, you said 20th century, but you mean 21st?
20th century, actually, but 21st okay. Is fine.
I thought you mean like contemporary issues.
Yeah, contemporary, yeah. You can answer in that light, yeah.
I mean, it just seems like a very broad...
It is, I'm sorry. You know, I've had this sort of thing before, so I was like, you know, I can answer this question like 10 million ways, you know, but as best as you can for the listeners.
In terms of cooperation and development, security support, I think, again, we see how the link between these regions were always there. The links were always there. I personally can speak more about the Israeli aspect of it. But I think in a way it is representative of broader dynamics that took place both in terms of African development and in terms of the way statehood in the Middle East was has changed over the years, and specifically Israeli statehood. If we talk about the 1960s and 50s, Israel invested quite a lot in formal government-to-government kind of support, both in terms of its development projects and its military assistance were always or mostly kind of government-led formal projects. And since the 80s, most clearly, there's been a process of kind of privatization of Israel in Africa. So Israel is still involved in quite a lot of business activities and, of course, security sales in Africa, but it's mostly private companies that do this today rather than formal Israeli government institutions. And in that sense, I think it's quite a significant shift in the way international politics work in general, in between these regions, but in between Israel and countries in Africa, more specifically. The Israeli investment in aid and in other forms of government-to-government support is actually marginal. It's almost non-existent. Israel doesn't put a lot of money in its diplomacy in Africa, but it encourages Israeli businesses and companies to operate in Africa. And African countries obviously sought to benefit from whatever Israel has to offer, which obviously throughout the years, security played quite a significant role in this. So Israeli security sales to Africa were always quite significant, but there are other fields in which Israeli involvement in Africa in terms of business activity and development is quite significant. That's kind of water infrastructure, agriculture, things like that.
Exactly. You talked about something that was very interesting. You talked about the shifting nature of statehood, you know, particularly on the African continent, where you had a lot of coups and you had a lot of governments, you know, that people had to deal with almost immediately. And also on the Middle Eastern side, you still have, you know, a lot of changing nature of what the state is. The state is constantly evolving, both in Africa and in the Middle East, as opposed to what we have in, say, Europe and certain parts of North America, where, I mean, for some people, you know, they've reached their final form. How important is this for how these states engage with each other, you know, navigating very peculiar concerns that they don't have to do with maybe other Western nations?
Most important kind of changes in the way the Israeli state looks like is obviously the war of 1967, where Israel turned from a state with concrete borders, even though it was surrounded perhaps by other countries that didn't have peace with it, to essentially an occupying state or a kind of a colonizing state in the Middle East that is partly a formal state with borders within which it has, you know, normal citizens, and then a state that also occupies certain territories in which it maintains kind of military control over populations of non-citizens as well. And the reason this is important for Israel's relationship with Africa, beyond the question of diplomatic support for the Israeli occupation, which Israel always sought to mobilize in Africa, is also that it changed the way the Israeli state operates and the way Israeli economy works. So throughout the 1970s, partly also because of the Yom Kippur War, Israeli security agencies became quite dominant actors, or increasingly dominant actors, within the Israeli state, which they were already before. And perhaps more importantly, the Israeli arms industry expanded quite massively. And in a sense, until today, Israel's kind of ability to produce the arms it needs in order to maintain itself as a state, as an occupying state in the Middle East, its ability to do that relies on its ability to export arms as well, to share what it develops with others, because its arms industry relies on the income that exports generate. And that's not only an economic issue, it's also a diplomatic issue, because when you as a state have let's say, certain intelligence equipment or security equipment that can facilitate, that can help, let's say, another government stay in power, then that's quite a strong diplomatic tool, something that you can offer to countries. And Israel was always, or at least most clearly from the 70s and 80s in Africa, used these abilities to forge ties with other countries. So that was obviously a very clear part of the Israeli alliance with apartheid South Africa during the 70s, but also during the 80s, all the countries that renewed ties with Israel. One of the most important things leaders needed was support with kind of security assistance that can help them stay in power, that can, what we may call, kind of coup-proof their regimes. So Mobutu was the first leader to renew ties with Israel in the early 80s. And one of the first things he asked for was Israeli support in training his presidential guards. And we've seen a number of other leaders doing that in the following years. And these relationships developed into quite significant and in a sense, long-lasting relationships. So if we look at one of the leaders that renewed ties with Israel in the 80s, was Paul Biya. And one of the things he asked in Cameroon, and one of the things he needed as well was help with training his presidential guards to kind of coup-proof his regime. And in a way, Israeli actors, today it's private actors, are still involved in his security arrangements until today. So this kind of industry has a lot of impact on Israel's international alliances. To get back to the question of statehood, I almost forgot how we got here. But I think the question of statehood kind of also, I think in this way, impacts how we think about Africa's role in these relationships as well. Because if we look at development in Africa as well, we see that in the late 50s and 60s, this was kind of the age of state-led development, in which countries invested or governments invested in development that was state-led, that has kind of a vision of a state, what people often refer to as kind of the high modernism kind of a vision of large developmental projects that kind of have the, or were believed to have the power to kind of modernize states and create nations through that as well. And at the time, Israeli assistance was also kind of state-led. State-led projects, Israel assisted with agricultural villages, starting factories, developing government bureaucracies, taxation, education, agriculture, all of these things. But I think on both sides of these relationships, we see how the state, under the influence of, because of the financial crisis of the 70s and 80s and the structural adjustment programs, countries in Africa are also kind of abandoning this age of state-led development kind of comes to an end. And we see investment in state-led development decreasing, whereas kind of private actors becoming more dominant in the way African states operate, both private actors and in many ways informal markets. And in a sense, the privatization of Israel's relationship with certain African countries kind of mirrors that, because increasingly it's not the Israeli state that operates in Africa, but it is all sorts of Israeli businessmen and intermediaries that have kind of a semi-official role where they maybe sell products that benefit them, but at the same time kind of advance the interests of the Israeli state. So that's kind of a broader shift, I think, on both sides from a state-led development kind of vision, or a vision of state-led development and nation building, to a more privatized kind of politics.
So now we speak with Amina El Abed from Tunis, Tunisia. She's managing partner at Impact Peace, a consulting firm with interest in Middle East and North Africa.
I think it has a lot to do with the way that these countries gained their independence, where in Tunisia and Morocco, it was more peaceful. And so it was easier for them to build relationship so that, you know, they stayed in good relationship with countries like France when they were, you know, colonized by them. And they wished to continue that because they saw that that's where their best interest was. Whereas, you know, a country like Algeria, you know, it was very, very violent the way that they got the French out. So it was normal to have, to be against anything that is Western at a time. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Russia, the Soviet Union, who first recognized Algeria as an independent state. So you have like these, you know, historical symbols. And that show why one would align with one or the other. So that's in terms of non-alignment, but actually pretty aligned, you know, North Africa. but then you see that a lot of them kind of played both sides, because it was a crucial period, you know, of reconstruction, of, you know, reaffirming your independence, of building your institutions, and you needed some help to do that. So you would ask, you know, for help from whoever would give it to you. But then if that wasn't working out, you would see some flirting with the other side. Like Tunisia, it was clearly pro-Western. You know, from the very beginning, you know, it was really announced that, you know, this is the route that it was taking. But, you know, right after the independence, the Habib Bourguiba, the president, he wanted to build Tunisia's defense system because we didn't have any. And so we reached out to Eisenhower, who was pretty sympathetic to Tunisians. But then, you know, the help, the aid did not come right away. It was stalled because it was pretty, you know, awkward. You know, the U.S. and France, pretty good friends. And, you know, it would be nice to move their, like, arms to Tunisians right after they kick out the French. And so you would see like some like small instances of, you know, flirting, going to talk to Soviet Union, exchanging, you know, teachers and doctors and stuff like that. But it wasn't as major as it was for, you know, Egypt, for example, where it was like true, you know, military trainings, giving them arms and so on, which led to, you know, the Suez crisis and so
exactly.
On.
Let's talk about that now. Let's talk about Egypt in general. So the 1956 Suez Crisis, such a crucial moment in not just the history of the region, but the history of the world.
Because
it sort of signaled the moment where the UK and France were, well, they were told they were old school and the new boys are coming down, and the US and the Soviet Union were the new powers. And that ushered in a very important moment, which is the rise of Pan-Arabism and the sort of cult of personality of Gamal Abdel Nasser. And
ours, Habib Bourguiba, they all had some kind of, they were weird. Cult of personality, isn't that, I don't know, it's an Arab-African thing, right? Where, you know, they come up and then they develop this thing, the me, I'm the best, I'm a miracle, I am the solution, I'm like the, I call God on the phone.
I call God on the phone. Exactly. But how did that arise? Like, how important was Nasser as an individual for the rise of this sort of Arab Renaissance, if I may use that term, around this period?
Another Arab Renaissance. So, I mean, Pan-Arabism is not really a new thing, but somehow it got linked to Nasser because he championed it because he was like, you know, against imperialism and Western powers, and this claim that, you know, the Arab nation who spanned from the Maghreb to the Persian Gulf, and that we were all one and somehow we had the same consciousness and same, you know, identity, which I think it's kind of ridiculous. But then
exactly, it's not even the same sort of Arabic spoken across the region.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, this is a region where you have all religions, and you have so many ethnic groups, and so it's really difficult for you to kind of unite people on that idea. What does it even mean? You know, even within Islam, because Pan-Arabism would clash with Pan-Islamism, is that a thing? I think it is, yeah. Where, you know, say that, you know, we shouldn't unite under the, you know, umbrella of, you know, being Arabs, but we should unite under the umbrella of, you know, religion. But that also doesn't make a lot of sense, because within, you know, you have the Shia and you have the Sunni, but then within these, they also have other, you know, subgroups, and they don't even get along. So that's already an issue. So you have the ethnic diversity, you have the religious diversity, and you have all of these egos of, you know, the leaders at a time who are competing against each other to be, you know, the leading face of, you know, this, you know, Arab nation of unification. So you had a lot of, you know, really funny attempts to create, you know, a unified, you know, like a country or a nation. I need to remember the names of them. Like you had the United Arab Republic.
Yeah, Syria and Egypt. Very short-lived.
Very short-lived, and then you had the Federation, Arab Federation, Jordan and Iraq, and then you had the one led by Gaddafi, the Arab Republic, and then you had an attempt to do one with Tunisia, Arab Islamic Republic, which thank God didn't happen. Because, I mean, when you look at, you know, how things have evolved and what is going on in Libya right now, that's not something that we would have survived as Tunisians, because, you know, it's too big for us.
The rise of Nasser, sort of, you know, after he left the scene, Sadat came on board, and Sadat was the first, not just the first Arab state, but the first African state in that region to recognize Israel.
Yeah.
And this was very important because it shifted the conflict from an Israeli-Arab conflict to an Israel-Palestine conflict. Because when you had one Arab state that recognized Israel, and then you now started having more states of course they didn't recognize Israel on the scene, but surreptitiously, they were all in line with Israel because Egypt was also a very powerful player. So how important was that for the region and the conflicts with Israel?
So first of all, you know, having the championing of pan-Arabism start in Egypt and also die in Egypt is very symbolic. So it wasn't taken so well because, you know, it's the one after the other. You have one who kind of created this whole thing and wanted to, you know, it was all defined by opposition to Israel, you know. Even our identity as Arabs, we were defining ourselves at the time by being against Israel. So it was all by opposition. And so, you know, and that gets, you know, kind of diffused into, you know, the culture and then your sense of identity and so on. And so when you're an Arab, you define yourself as, you know, I'm Arab, I speak Arabic, I'm probably Muslim. And then you have the guy that comes right after and is like, oh, you guys continue doing that. I'm just going to do my thing now. And, you know, my country's interests prevail, all this nonsense. So he was received as a big stab in the back by everybody, kind of it further shook the already very fragile
alliance.
You know, definition that we had and alliances that we had at the time. But I don't know if it shifted from, you know, an Arab Israeli war to a Palestinian Israeli conflict, let's say, because as you say, it's not very direct. There are a lot of countries, at least, you know, the people of this country are still very much opposed to normalization.
I mean, if you take Jordan, for example, on the face of it, we're a complete enemy of Israel, but we're always feeding all the plans back to Israel, what was about to happen. So that's just like another angle to the whole story.
Yeah, because it's like national interests and, you know, this ideological interests, and ideological interests here kind of falls because, you know, Jordan is a small country that's very dependent on, you know, the U.S. And so you can't, there is not much opposition that you can realistically have if you want to continue to exist, because, you know, it's right in the middle, you know, of all of the conflict. It's a very sensitive, you know, so you're going to have to be realistic there. So that's understandable from maybe a strategic point of view and from, you know, national interest versus ideologies and, you know, what the heart wants.
Exactly.
Point of view. Even though, you know, it's not very popular. But, you know, before Sadat, you know, he was the first to do the normalization with Israel and signing the treaty and so on. But it wasn't the first time that a leader kind of questioned you know, the policy that Arab nations had against Israel. So if you look, and if you want to, you know, I'll try to find for you the clip of, you know, Bourguiba's Jericho speech in 1965, mm-hmm. Where he got all of these leaders upset because, well, he pronounced this speech and he obviously reiterated, you know, his support to, you know, the independence of Palestinians and so on. But he was very critical of, you know, the Arab states' policy of all or nothing. So we either get everything and we kick out Israel and so on, or we get nothing in this. And he was saying that Israel is here. It's not going to leave anytime soon. So we better find a way to get to compromise, you know, to maybe, you know, like recognize, you know, that they can cohabitate. And then, you know, once you reach that state and you get, you know, a recognized state of Palestine, then you can build on that. And I think you could see, you could find in documentaries like his picture in Tunisian flag being burned out and so on for him to even say that kind of stuff at the time. Actually, even though Tunisia still has not normalized, mm-hmm. you know, Israel. And now I think we're getting even more aggressive. You know, because of, you know, the, what is going on over there. I mean, Israel is not respecting a lot of the agreements that are, have been made.
And, exactly. It's an apartheid state, really.
Yeah. And also there is a renewed kind of enthusiasm towards pan-Arabism right now. I feel, at least, you know, in Tunisia and from the countries in which I have worked. I think it's like a mechanism because, you know, everything is shaken right now. And so we're looking for unity, for a sense of community and so on. And so and we're looking for, you know, a source of, you know, glory, something to hold on to. Mm. And so you can hear now in, you know, new politicians that are trying to emerge and they are reiterating those ideas. Like the new president of Tunisia is very into that kind of stuff. And so it kind of feels like we're back in the 70s and in the 80s in Tunisia where, you know, you have the students' movements, you know, against oppression in Israel and kind of a bit communist ideas floating around. So you're seeing that this is doing a little bit of a comeback.
Interesting. I mean, this leads us to the next point. So Tunisia, for example, Bourguiba was there from, I think, 58, 57 to like 87.
There from 56 to 87.
So people could have, you know, been born, had girlfriends, died, and still he would have been there. That's like at least 20 years. So yeah. Other countries as well were affected by sort of authoritarian rule, and people being there in situ, and a very military-minded version of what the state was meant to be. Now, the question is, how exactly did this influence foreign policy for Northern Africa in the latter part of the 20th century? How did they relate to the other African countries and also the major powers and then other international organizations like the United Nations and other things?
Yeah, so they are a bit different because you have like Morocco, which is a monarchy, and then you have Algeria, which is very police and heavy military, and you know, just a very closed off country that's relying on, you know, security, very focused on that. Then you have Tunisia, which has nothing. We never invested in military because it's just, you know, we know that we're too small to rely on that. So we kind of went into the direction of being friends with everybody. I'm putting it in harsh words, but it was kind of a policy of, you know, we kind of Habib Bourguiba wanted to be kind of the voice of reason in the third world, whatever that means. But that was the ambition that he had for himself. It was very, very, you know, the cult of personality and all of that. It was a lot of nonsense. But then, you know, he really wanted to position himself as you know, the spokesman of peace and one who translates everybody's interests and so on in the region. And so we went kind of a different route where it was authoritarian, but it was very open at the same time. It was a very strange mix, at least on the surface. This is how it appeared. And then you had Libya with Gaddafi, and we know how that was. And then you have Egypt, which is, again, military. And you see that in these countries, you know, the thing that is common between Algeria, Libya, and Egypt is that it's been, I mean, the people who were in power all had a military background. When you have in Morocco monarchy, which is different than in Tunisia, was a lawyer.
But we're talking about the region and the foreign policy, and you stopped at how, you know, you were describing how each nation was constituted and the leadership. So in Libya, in Tunisia, and how they governed themselves internally. And we're about to now jump into how they navigated the foreign powers and international
how
state.
They relate to the rest of the world. So I think that I really admire Morocco's policies towards, you know, the rest of Africa. They're doing such a good job on opening up to Africa, which in Tunisia we're not quite there yet, even though we've been speaking since the 50s about, you know, our Arabic, our African roots and how we need to open up more, you know, to Africa and, you know, be more present there because, you know, it's just, you know, who we are. We are African, and we tend to forget that as North Africans. We don't even do enough trade amongst ourselves.
It's true. I don't know. Why is that, though? Why is that, like, you know, it's northern half of Africa, the leadership, the people, many of them don't believe that they are part of the African continent. And, well, many scholars and academics and different people have always tried to, you know, keep on going with this narrative and divide sub-Saharan Africa and the rest of Africa. Like, why do you think that's, in your own opinion? I mean, you can't have a definitive answer, but in your own opinion.
I think North Africans have a weird identity, and we're kind of living in a perpetual identity crisis where we're African, we're Arabs, we're Mediterranean, we're closer to Italy and France than we're, you know, to, you know, the neighbors. Our mindset, we feel like we're open. We also, you know, watched a lot of Egyptian movies growing up, and it's a mishmash of all of these cultures that are around us, but at the same time we feel like none of them really match who we actually are. So it's a perpetual identity crisis and that's going to keep changing, you know, as we get new leaders, as we get, you know, new thinkers. That's going to help, you know, shape how we identify ourselves. But a funny thing is that I think there was a survey that was made about in the Middle East and North Africa where they asked people what they identified with. And a lot of them said that we identify as Muslim first and then, you know, Arab. And then they say their, you know, country of origin. Very few said Africa. I think Algeria said Africa as number two. I don't know who else, but Tunisia said Tunisian first and then everything else behind it. So we also have different kind of feelings of, you know, or attachment to national identity. And maybe it makes us a bit closed off because we're too focused, we're too inwards, you know, to kind of, you know, be open. This is as people. And I think this comes from the fact that we've been, you know, cut off from politics for such a long time. So we haven't really focused on how, you know, things are being decided for us in terms of our relationships with different nations. We've always, you know, left that in the hands of whoever is in charge. And I think that's valid for all of the countries in North Africa. But I think that we kind of, as Tunisians, we kind of still have up to today, even after, you know, we had the Nahda party, which is Islamic party, take over. And then we had, like, I think we were I think we have had 11 governments right now after the revolution, which is so many. We're still talking about Bourguiba, first of all, still omnipresent. We're still using, you know, the foundation that he laid for, you know, our foreign policy. But then I don't think we have a vision, you know, for our relationships and what we want to build, you know, in a, with the countries around us. I think we're living on a day-to-day basis, and our economic dependence has left us, you know, in a place where we're not as assertive as before, and where, you know, we can't really, it's kind of a bit ridiculous for us to have strong stances right now to say, oh, I'm against this, or I'm going to cut off ties with this, or, you know, I'm going to do that. No, you can't afford to do that anymore, because mm-hmm. you're so much in debt that, you know, you're kind of following whatever the countries are giving you money. You know, you find yourselves in alliances that are perhaps against, you know, your principles, you know, for conducting foreign policy. Like in Tunisia, for example, we are part of the alliance, you know, with Saudi Arabia, which is bombing Yemen. But we're, that's not who we are. But, you know, we're
part of an alliance, exactly.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think the next question I'm going to ask is, like, I mean, from all my conversations so far, something I've sort of picked upon is what you just talked about in detail. And why is that? Like, from North Africa, you know, with Tunisia that you just mentioned, or like Algeria that had such a very assertive idea of what they wanted Algeria to be and basically kicked the French out and distorted all of French society while doing this, to in West Africa, you see, in Ghana, they kicked the British out. The same thing like in East Africa, Kenya as well. You know, basically, you know, violently, peacefully, however, remove these people. In South Africa as well, dismantled apartheid. Yeah. That almost like 50 years on, all these nations across the entire continent, they have no vision of what they want to do on the international stage. They're just being pulled apart. Why do you think this is this? I don't know. You mentioned like debts and, you know, of course, politicians as well nowadays just want to win the next election. But
yeah,
I think it's deeper than that. I don't know why. And I guess I'm just asking you a question that even I don't know the answer to. But
I think it's the, first of all, we don't have, you know, strong structures in our countries. You know, the reason, you know, we don't have strong institutions, it's kind of all over the place. We don't have a lot of transparency. Democracy is a bit so-so, and we haven't. I don't think we're too open to difference or different opinions coexisting, or different, you know, ways of viewing the world, and so we have a lot of internal conflicts, and we often, I think, we import, you know, conflicts from outside in the world into our own internal politics, and we start fighting about that. And, you know, there is the issue of, as we said, you know, debt being codependent, you know, on other countries, on stronger forces. It's also, you know, the whole world order that's keeping, you know, us in a certain state. Where, you know, how can we get out of this dependence, you know, to other countries where we, I don't know.